You're listening to 9 Plus, a research podcast from SETU Ireland. Welcome to a special episode of 9 Plus. My name is Rob O'Connor. This one is a bit different to our usual episodes. You'll be happy to know that I hardly feature at all. This episode has been produced as a companion piece for an upcoming issue of the Journal of Research in Nursing and is a collaboration between academics from the Southeast Technological University in Ireland and Glasgow Caledonian University in Scotland. We recorded a conversation between nursing academics and students about how COVID impacted their PhD research. In Waterford, we had Mark White, Trish Hunt and Teresa Dowling, all with SETU. Online, we had Gordon Hill, Matilda Pieri and Kira Marie Ryan, all from Glasgow Caledonian. Technically, it was a challenge to facilitate a six-way talk, some in person and some online, but the conversation that was captured was worth the effort. The panel discussed how their research projects had to change because of the pandemic, the drawbacks and even the benefits. What I found most interesting were all the intangible or unexpected revelations. For example, Kira talking about how she found it difficult to speak with people for her study via Zoom during the pandemic. The patients would often open up about issues that were affecting them and she was unable to help. That kind of stuff must have been hard to process. So, without further preamble, I'll hand over to Mark, Trish, Teresa, Kira and Mathilde. The next voice you'll hear is Gordon Hill introducing things.
Welcome to this podcast, which is a collaboration between Southeast Technological University in the Republic of Ireland and Glasgow Caledonian University in Scotland, in conjunction with the Journal of Research in Nursing. My name is Gordon Hill and I am the Assistant Head for International in the School of Health and Life Sciences at GCU, and I'll be co-hosting this podcast with Mark White. Mark is the Vice President for Research, Innovation and Graduate Studies at SETU. We are delighted to be joined in the podcast by Matilda, Kira, Teresa and Trish, who will be telling us about their experiences of conducting their doctoral studies during the COVID pandemic. So I'll hand over to Mark to ask the first question.
Thanks, Gordon. And I don't know if anybody has any experience of pub PhDs, but that's where you get to talk about your PhD in a very concise and short period of time. And I think I'm going to start with Trish, who's sitting opposite me in the studio here. And I'm just going to ask Trish to give us a brief overview of the study that she conducted as part of her PhD, which happened during the pandemic.
Sure. Thanks, Mark. Yeah, my PhD looked at examining professional quality of life in cancer healthcare professionals, looking at the relationship to empathy and emotional intelligence. And my own clinical background was as a cancer nurse. So I kind of understood the emotional labour. It was always, you know, at the back of my mind that, you know, that nurses or healthcare professionals working in cancer had some sort of emotional labour. So it was always of interest to me. So, you know, the literature is clear that cancer care is stressful. And my study was a mixed methods study. So in phase one, I collected demographics and collected information on professional quality of life, empathy and emotional intelligence. And then I went on to interview healthcare professionals. And the results showed in Ireland that we have high levels of secondary traumatic stress in cancer healthcare professionals, and that nurses and radiation therapists draw parallels with their own families when they empathise with patients, and that they, you know, that they find it difficult to disconnect from the emotional sort of labour of cancer care.
Okay. Thanks, Trish. That's really, really good. I'm going to go over to Kira next, who's not expecting to be next, but Kira, would you like to give us maybe a 30-second, one-minute overview of your study and your PhD and what you've been conducting over the last number of years?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you very much. So the aim of my PhD project was to develop a self-management intervention for people who are living in the community with stroke-related vision impairment. So it encompassed three different studies. So the first study was a mixed method systematic review because there is no existing interventions for people with stroke-related vision impairment. I looked at the field of general visual impairment and also at stroke. So I looked at all the existing interventions that were available from both fields with the aim of combining the quantitative and qualitative data associated with that together. Then I did a qualitative study where I interviewed people living with different forms of stroke-related vision impairment to gather information as to what their experience was living this the impairment that they had and what kind of management strategies or supports and services that they had accessed. And then in the final study, I did a series of focus groups with lots of different stakeholders, so clinicians and people living with stroke-related vision impairment as well, to draw all the previous data together, so the qualitative data and everything that I'd learned from the mixed method systematic review to design the self-management intervention.
Wow, and well done. That was pretty concise. I'm going to hand over to Teresa now. And Teresa, you might just give us an overview of your PhD study and what it entailed.
Delighted to, Mark. Thanks. So I looked at, mine was a two-phase study, and I looked at contextual factors in Irish healthcare that will influence the success or failure of advanced healthcare directives, which are coming down the line at us with high speed here. So in the first phase, I talked to discharge coordinators in hospitals, a specific group of nurses, and then I took the findings from there to phase two of the study, which spoke to doctors, GPs, paramedics, and a variety of different types of nurses to look at the landscape, I suppose, for advanced healthcare directives. And that's still an ongoing project. So the phase two is both qual and quan in terms of methodology. And I'm using group concept mapping across all those healthcare professional groups to achieve my results.
Excellent. And it's good to hear that you're still in the middle of that. And we might chat about that a little bit later. I'm going to hand over to Matilde now. Matilde, if you could tell us a little bit about your study and what it entailed and the title, etc.
Sure, thanks, Mark. Yes, so my PhD has been funded by the UK Stroke Association, and it is a complementary project of the Heads Up research. Heads Up stands for Helping Ease Anxiety and Depression Following Stroke. And it is an ongoing research at Glasgow Caledonia University led by Professor Maggie Lawrence, and aimed to devise an adaptation of the Kabat-Zinn mindfulness-based stress reduction course to help stroke survivors and their families members self-manage anxiety and depression. And my PhD is aimed to co-develop a further adaptation of this course to make it accessible specifically for people with aphasia and their family members. As for those who don't know this, aphasia is an acquired language disorder which can impact the ability to speak, understand speech, read, write, and perform calculations. And many people with aphasia after a stroke struggle with mood disorders, but having access to traditional psychotherapy interventions can be a real challenge for them following their communication difficulties. And that's why we think that a mindfulness-based intervention, which entails a reduced linguistic demand, might help. However, we still, you know, in mindfulness, there are still some abstract concepts, and so we need to make it easy to follow for people with aphasia. And to do so, we use like a patient and public involvement approach. And as Kira said, similarly to Kira, my research involved three steps. And the first step was actually to conduct a systematic review to explore the existing mind, body and creative art interventions for people with aphasia, and which were the barriers and the facilitators for these interventions to support the well-being of people with aphasia. And then the study two involved establishing a lasting collaboration with an advisory group of people with direct experience of aphasia who helped me throughout my study to make sure that all the resources were accessible for the participants with aphasia. And then the study three was actually a co-creation study during which I collaborated with two groups of stakeholders, people with aphasia, and health professionals to develop the aphasia-friendly adaptation.
Great.
Thank you.
No, Matilda, that's really interesting. And we might get into the co-design element of that later on in our conversation. What stage of your PhD are you currently at?
Yes, I'm on my final year. Yes. So I'm actually finishing my data analysis and writing my thesis at the moment. Yeah.
Excellent. And Kira?
I'm just in the very, very final stages of writing off. So I'm experiencing the slog that everyone refers to when they get to the end stage.
Okay.
I'm nearly there.
Great, that's great. And Patricia, you're just finished, aren't you?
I finished actually not long, I suppose, after the first lockdown. I'm finished now, probably 2 years, yeah.
And Teresa, you reckon you're in the last lap?
Yes, hopefully. So I plan to submit in late summer. So I'm just completing data collection and analysis as we speak.
Excellent. Gordon, I'm going to hand over to you now. And if you want to get into the next round of questions there.
Thanks, Mark. I wonder if we could now move on to what you planned to do for your research and how that changed over COVID. Teresa, would you like to kick us off with that one?
Certainly. I lost my entire sample group because of COVID. I had originally, my study was to be, phase one of the study was to be with public health nurses, but understandably they were redeployed during COVID, and the management, public health management, just refused to take part, understandably. So I had to go back to square one and I suppose find another sample group. So I identified the discharge coordinator nurses as a potential sample group, and I suppose all's well that ends well, they provided very rich data indeed, so I was delighted with the way it ended up, but I suppose it just was a challenge that I had to overcome.
Okay, thank you very much for that, Teresa. Trish, how about yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I was fortunate enough that I had collected all my data, you know, prior to COVID, so I was in the write-up phase. So in fact, it was good for me. I was, you know, at home, obviously teaching as well. It was probably a bit difficult because I was used to having face-to-face meetings with my supervisors, so that all of that went online, a lot by email. You know, but for me, it didn't affect me as much because I had done the data collection phase. But I think the challenge of online teaching and changing to that ate a lot into my time. So I suppose the write-up took longer than I thought because of COVID.
Thanks very much for that, Trish. Matilda, how about you?
Thank you, Gordon. Yes. Yeah, so as I was saying before, for my PhD study, I planned to use co-creation methods. And when COVID hit, I was on my first year of my PhD. So luckily enough, I was still at this stage of planning my study. And I was able, therefore, to change the plan for the study and be able to change the setting from face-to-face to online. So originally I was planning to hold co-creation meetings and mindfulness taster sessions in person, but following COVID restrictions, we had to change the plan and make a decision around like which conference platform, video conference platform to use. And these also implied some changes to the recruitment criteria for the participants, who of course had to, you know, not only have a computer and internet access, but also being able to use, a video conference platform. And this also entails changes in like how to support people, especially with aphasia, who already struggle with communication to join online meetings. And so we had to develop some bespoke resources run training sessions to make sure that everyone was able to actually engage with the research.
Thank you, Matilda. And lastly, to yourself, Kira.
Yeah, well, thank you very much, Gordon. I suppose I was quite lucky in many ways in that I suppose I kind of did my PhD project in the way I'd intended, albeit it was just moved online. But I suppose a lot of the challenges I had, because I was working with a population of stroke-related vision impairment, recruitment was very, very tricky. So when COVID hit, I was just at the stage where I'd finished my mixed method systematic review. So I was moving into the qualitative phases of my work. So it was really, really difficult to recruit people who have vision impairments. I suppose during COVID, people kind of pivoted to the use of social media, I suppose, to kind of recruit people. So I suppose naturally these people typically aren't on social media platforms. So recruitment took me a very long time. Similarly, a lot of clinicians were redeployed. So kind of going through that route of asking clinicians to recruit people was quite difficult as well, because a lot of them had been redeployed to more acute settings. So that was quite difficult as well. And similar to some of the references that Mathilde made, just making kind of bespoke materials and putting in extra training to kind of facilitate people with these different kind of stroke-related vision impairments, and I suppose other impairments as well, and to be able to engage in an online platform as well. Because I suppose at the time, even though it's kind of really familiar to us in our everyday lives, it was kind of a bit kind of abrupt, I suppose, at the time, this big kind of shift online. I suppose another difficulty was, because part of my qualitative work was really kind of getting into the management strategies and supports and services that people had accessed, a lot of these had ceased or severely reduced. So people were kind of telling me that, you know, I don't really have any access to any services just now, and I'm really conscious of the impact that that's going to have on my recovery. So I think it was quite difficult to hear at times the difficulties that people were having, and because of this pandemic, that they weren't getting the support that they needed.
Thanks, Kira. Yeah, and I remember just immediately prior to COVID, somebody had said about doing some work on Teams, and I'd never heard of Teams. And it's amazing thinking now that that's the sort of technology that we'd never heard of or never used before, but now we're so familiar with. Trish, can you tell us about the kind of implications and the kind of changes that you had to make for your research, please?
Yeah, so... I suppose COVID had a lot less impact on my research, because I already had a lot of my data, you know, collected already, and, you know, didn't have to make any changes. The write-up period was, for me, I was used to, you know, sort of teeing in face to face with my supervisors, and had a really good relationship that way. So suddenly everything went online by email. So, you know, for me, I found that challenging, but I certainly didn't have the same challenges that the other three here have had, because I had my data already collected. But, you know, it was still challenging trying to juggle the online teaching, which was new and expanding, and then trying to write up and finish the analysis.
Sure. And how about your supervision then, Trish? I take it that all was all online then?
It was, yeah, that changed to all online completely. Yeah, it did, Gordon. So, but, you know, with Zoom or Teams, Microsoft Teams and email, it did, you know, it made it really easy, you know, just to pick up from the kind of face-to-face meetings. But I think probably I found, anyway, personally, the face-to-face meetings much more productive. So, you know, had to be really focused and, you know, have a clear idea before jumping onto Zoom or Teams as to what I needed, you know, to ask my supervisors or whatever. But they were, you know, kind of very available, so it worked out well.
And Teresa, how about you? What kind of adaptations did you have to make in terms of your doctorate?
Well, I was right in the thick of COVID when I was collecting the data, and I was running focus groups as well. So I was kind of determined to get into the hospitals, but I did need to get special permission, which was unusual, because I'd be used to sort of walking freely through the hospital. So I needed special permission to enter. The rules of the day were changing very constantly around COVID, in terms of for some of my focus groups, there was a maximum of 6 people in a room. And then so I couldn't bring a research assistant, and, you know, there were various different limits like that. And then it would change the next week, and 10 would be allowed in a room, and then it would be reduced again the following week. So from week to week, things were changing at high speed. Lots of adaptations. I mean, I got there in the end, and I got all the data I needed, and I had all the meetings in a face-to-face way, but maybe not as big as I would have liked.
I wonder if you could maybe all say just about whether it also had impact on the outputs that you had. I mean, were you intending to present at conferences? Did it have an impact on any publications that you were going to be having? I don't know if you just want to have a chat yourselves, or Or maybe Matilda, do you want to start with that?
Yes, definitely. So I've been doing my PhD for like more than 3 years right now. And the first chance to present in person was actually this autumn that I had. So it was quite kind of strange that all my experiences were like to present were online. And although like presenting in person at first like scared me a little bit, I actually, after experiencing it, I realized that for me, it was actually easier. Because I think when you present online, you often don't have, you cannot see the audience. So you miss those like kind of social and nonverbal cues that actually help you while you're delivering a presentation. So luckily I was still able to engage with like, you know, having e-poster presentations or actual talks. But it was a new kind of way of delivering the information. Regarding publications, I don't think I had any other issue because, again, like it's a similar way of you need to write your paper. But it was just for the presentations that it was different.
Yeah, I think so. And I think I know myself, if I'm presenting live, then I usually kind of fix on someone who's smiling and nodding. And that's much more difficult to do sometimes when you're presenting online.
Yeah.
Kira, sorry, Matilda.
Oh, no, sorry. I was just adding that also attending a conference in person, you know, you have so many more opportunities to network with other people. So I think by presenting online, you miss that.
Yeah, sure. And I think the opportunity to kind of discuss and sort of articulate verbally what your research about is actually really important and can help with kind of the viva when you come to that stage as well. So, Kira, how about yourself?
Yeah, thank you, Gordon. I think just to echo what Matilda said, I've actually, for the duration of my PhD, not been to a face-to-face conference. They've just been online. But I suppose during your PhD, when you're kind of in the depths of kind of analysis and stuff, you really kind of look forward to going to face-to-face conferences and the opportunity to present and talk about your research. And I suppose meet these really important people that you've been citing throughout your work. So I think it's a bit of a shame that I feel I've kind of missed out on that a little bit. But I suppose presenting online has brought in itself a whole new skill set as well that had to be drawn on. So making presentations and kind of laboring over the audio recordings that go in them and making sure that you can condense your research down to 2 or 3 minutes. So I think even though it's obviously face-to-face, I think is the general consensus that that's optimal. I suppose it's still been great that we've been able to engage in conferences online. And I suppose because I'm at the stage of just writing up as well, I think sometimes when I'm just doing the final revisions on my thesis, it's quite unnerving to kind of go back and read the data because when I collected my data, it was in the kind of second lockdown where things had really kind of stopped. So when you look back, you're kind of like, oh, this is really strange. And you really kind of have to take yourself back to be like, oh, but that's what things were like at the time. It was actually quite scary and things had stopped and we were limited to how far we could go from our houses. So when I kind of look back to revise my thesis, I'm like, I think this might be strange in a vibe to be like reminding the examiners of this, to kind of bring them back to what things were like during COVID, I suppose, if that makes sense at all.
No, it absolutely does. And I think the context that the research is conducted in is hugely important. And I think that's something that I'm sure does and will come out in terms of viva discussions and so forth. So, Trish, how about yourself?
Yeah, for me, I suppose, again, just, you know, same as Matilda and Kira, I kind of didn't present online. I didn't put in for any of the online conferences because I did feel that, you know, I would rather face-to-face, the networking opportunities. So I did have the opportunity then to present there in September in 2022 at EONS. And I kind of was really glad that I did wait to do that because, you know, made some connections then with some other people in Europe and, you know, that really benefited me. And even in terms of writing a manuscript, I think the lockdown, I think because it had an impact on work as well in terms of, you know, delivering teaching online is very different to face to face and, you know, took time. So it did impact on the time available to say to write a manuscript. So I felt that probably all that has been delayed slightly. But, you know, I think with everything opening up again, it's given us that opportunity to
sort of get back to face to face. And so it was challenging, and for me I think it did slow down my output for sure.
And Teresa, how about you?
I hate to disagree with a colleague, but I actually had a different approach to the conferences, in that I probably did an awful lot more than I would have ordinarily, because there was so much availability for the to attend things at a distance that were now online, so they were just a bit more convenient. So I probably did more conferences than I would ordinarily have done because of COVID. But there you go.
Fabulous. Excellent. I'll hand back to Mark now then.
Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot, Gordon. Yeah, some great impacts have come across there in relation to that time during COVID. I'm particularly taken with the impact that this may have had on you, Matilda, and just because of the co-design element of your study, and with people with aphasia, they may be an older generation. I know there's probably a mixed group and a mixed sample that you worked with there, but I'm assuming then that you had a part of your intervention was to teach and show technology to the cohort that you were dealing with, and was that difficult, or did you have to do that, or were people savvy enough with technology to be able to work with you?
And actually, yes, it was an extra challenge that was unforeseen, so the first choice was actually which type of video conference platform to use. And there was not much evidence in the literature of online intervention, so making a choice was quite difficult. And then so I asked, like, I had some anecdotal knowledge, but people with aphasia prefer using Zoom, as they were already exposed to some online groups. But at the time, Zoom was not supported by my university. And so I had to amend my ethics application and include a data protection impact assessment form, because Zoom processed data outside EU. And so that, well, was an extra challenge, because following that, we also had to devise some privacy notes, and these to make it that type of forms, we are quite heavy with like a jargon language, accessible for people with aphasia was an initial challenge. But okay. Also, as you...
Well, I'm seeing it as an opportunity, Matilda. So you're because I'm thinking you're teaching these people who wouldn't be in a study how to use technology. So that was what I took from it, is that if it wasn't for you, they would be trying to stumble across the technology and use it. But you've essentially empowered a group of aphasia sufferers or clients, patients. Do you see it that way?
Yeah, that's actually a good perspective to see it that way. And actually, that was kind of what happened, because as Kira was saying, during the pandemic, there was lots of isolation as well. So I think that giving them the opportunity to engage with something online was for them also a way to connect with other people having the same experience, and having, feeling that they could help somehow with the research. I think those some of the highlights of experience. But definitely helping them to join online was like a challenge, but at the same time, I think, we had to run some extra sessions with some, helping them, especially one-to-one support with some people, but other people were already familiar with the system because they were joining online groups. So, yeah.
Okay.
But, yeah, but that was a positive. Yeah.
And what about you, Teresa? Teresa, do you see... because you had to go, and use different techniques with patients and your study group. Was there an element of teaching? Was there kind of any positive bits that came out of the pivot that you had to do?
definitely. I ended up with a really nice set of results from phase one. But I suppose in terms of opportunities, I see the biggest opportunity that I see is in for phase two, for the scope for online data collection. It's enormous because I went wider on phase two of my study to multidisciplinary groups, and advanced healthcare directives are still a sort of a niche area. Awareness is still very low across the disciplines. So it made it easier for me to get the, you know, get people nationally up and down the country via Zoom rather than sticking to local groups, you know, so I could get people with good awareness to speak to me. So that's been an enormous opportunity. It's opened, you know, a much larger group of participants, I think, to me. So it's been great.
That's great. And Ciara, as you were talking, I was thinking this is a great opportunity for you to spin a story to your in your Viva. You know, you can play a little bit of a victim role here, that you were resourceful, that you had to pivot, that it wasn't as you planned. And I don't think you realise how powerful a story that will be in the middle of your Viva. I'm really taken by that. But I don't know what your thoughts are about using that material in your Viva, or whether you have a reflective piece in your thesis. Do you have a reflective chapter?
No, I don't, Mark, actually, but thank you very much. I think that's definitely something that's worth considering. I suppose I'm just reflecting on what everyone is saying about, even though using online platforms enabled us, I suppose, to carry on and to get a broader sample, I suppose, in a lot of respects. I think coming from a health background, so I'm an occupational therapist myself, and because I suppose the nature of the content that people were talking about, the services that stopped, that they were conscious of the impact that it was having on their recovery, they felt so isolated. I felt quite cold, and it really kind of bothered me that people were telling me their stories and, you know, the impact that this abrupt vision impairment was having on their lives, and I was just on the other end of a screen. You know, it felt really cold, and it stripped of the kind of warmth that maybe I could have offered if I was in a face-to-face capacity. So I think that's something that, you know, I think there certainly is pros and cons, but I think something that really bothered me, that I really worried that it was like cold, and I was just, they were really offering their story, and I was just kind of just taking it for the purpose of research. I don't know, maybe that's a bit harsh, but yeah. I think that's worth noting as well.
Yeah, no, and that's quite powerful, a powerful story, because if that was a face-to-face intervention or a face-to-face meeting, you could follow that up with something else. And I think maybe when you're online, the follow-up is not there, is it?
No, definitely not. I think people kind of end, and it just felt a bit cold, I think. When people were offering such a kind of insight into such a kind of abrupt event in their life and the impact that it had, I think it's, yeah.
Yeah. I'm just going to ask Trish, and I hope you don't mind me asking, Trish, because this all happened at the end of your PhD.
Indeed.
And did you see any advantages of not having to drag yourself in and have face-to-face dialogue with your supervisors? Because Ciara's going through this at the moment. When you're writing up, it's where you have most of your diverse views as to what the thesis will look like. Did it work to your advantage to be online, do you think?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, as you say, the thesis really starts to come together, doesn't it? That last bit. I think in a way, lockdown was a gift for me. And I did talk about, I know that my supervisors, you know, I couldn't meet them face to face. But, trying to do that analysis and discussion and have that headspace to do it, you know, there was nothing else to distract me. You know, there was nothing open. Obviously work was locked down, but you couldn't even go out for a coffee or anything. And I think it allowed me to be a bit creative. Like, even I think I had a mathematician here in SETU who did help me with some of the stats. And I met her on the beach, you know, so we had a little chat on the beach. Then, you know, she told me kind of what she might need from me. I was able to go email her. So it was kind of using those opportunities to just try and, you know, get that analysis and discussion completed. Yeah, so I would say a gift for me, but definitely being creative without. And that's the, I think, the opportunity for everybody is to, you know, whether it's during lockdown or not, is to use that creativity and use those challenges and develop them into an opportunity and just think a little bit more broadly as to how you can achieve things, whatever phase you're in of your PhD, I think.
Great. No, that's really, really good. I love the image of a PhD meeting their advisor on the beach, particularly when it comes to statistics.
Yeah, and we were in our swimsuits, believe it or not. We were both going swimming, so yeah.
Okay, yeah. And the imagery just continues to get
that's
broader.
Not a good,
down.
Yeah, that's not good, is it?
Okay, I'm going to ask a difficult question now. Kira has alluded to a little bit of it in her responses there, but if you're to reflect back, what would you do differently? Because this was a crisis and people were thinking on their feet, and people were having to pivot and readjust and do things a little bit differently. So if you were to go back in time, what would you do differently? Firstly, and secondly, what advice would you give to another PhD student who would find themselves in another crisis, for example? And we know there's always going to be something in the world, but there's always a crisis of some sort. So I'm going to start with Kira. Kira, would you have done anything differently? Or are you happy with the way things have gone for you and your study?
I suppose I am happy with the way things have gone. I suppose I did what I intended to do, albeit online, and I suppose the challenges, I just had a time implication. But I suppose if I was to give advice to myself, if I was to go back, I think I'd gone straight from undergraduate into PhD studies. So I think I felt quite insecure in my skills, and whenever I was following a method, I wanted to follow it to the T. And if there was disruptions to my timelines, it was quite difficult for me, and I really didn't like that. So I suppose if I could give any advice to myself, my past self, or to anyone else, I think, you know, if COVID taught us anything, it's that we can be really flexible and we can achieve things in lots of different ways. There's not just one way of doing things. There's lots of different ways that we can do it to achieve the same outcome, albeit the way that we get there is different. So I think it's just to be kind of more open to different ways of doing things and being open to being more flexible. And I suppose something that I really, when I think about all the pivots that I had to make, even though, of course, there's so much more literature now on, you know, online platforms delivering interventions online, even just talking to people from lots of different fields who've done similar things and the experience that people hold that may not necessarily be down on paper in journals or in textbooks, it's really, really useful to talk to people who've been through similar processes and really draw from their experience as well when you're planning different studies and implementing different methods, I suppose.
Yeah, no, that's really important, I think. And thanks for that, Kira. Teresa. Is there, looking back now to that first phase and that busy data collection period for you, and probably coming to the end of your literature review, it may have when some of this may have happened. Is there anything you would do differently, or if there was another crisis, what advice would you give to a PhD student who would find themselves in the same situations as you did?
Oddly enough, there's probably not a lot that I would do differently. I'm kind of happy with how it turned out, notwithstanding all the sort of bends in the road and everything. But I think I would have appreciated somebody saying to me at the start just to sort of lean into the unpredictability of the road, you know, because I think had it not been COVID, it would have been something else. I think we're all just sort of making it up as we go along. You know, I think there's a kind of an ebb and a flow in the process. And I think, you know, there are times that are really frantic and seem really busy, and then times when it feels like you're achieving nothing. But, you know, I think that thinking of those quiet times is really important too. So I suppose I just would say to people, you know, just to accept that they need to be flexible. Yeah, that's really all the advice I have to
Great.
Give.
Great. And Matilda, what if you were to go back, and I'm intrigued and by your study because of the co-design element of it, because it involves a lot of other people and not just yourself. If you were to go back and do something different when you think back, what would that be, and what advice would you give to a PhD student if they found themselves in a similar crisis?
Yeah, definitely. So specifically to my research project, SVS was a co-creation project, which is like an iterative process and is quite emergent and unpredictable by nature. What I will do different was like when a time I have to write my ethics application, I think, you know, you're required to be very specific, but I think I will also leave a little bit of room for flexibility because, you know, many decisions are made during actually the co-creation meetings. And you need to value your stakeholders' opinion and preferences. So I will try to write the ethics application in maybe in a wiser way to allow for some room for, you know, flexibility or alternative options. My advice to other PhD students will be to be prepared for things not going as planned, and to be flexible and to be open to this because, you know, a PhD is a long journey and is made of ups and downs. So there are going to be time when you are going to struggle. And as Akira was saying, don't be afraid when you struggle to ask for help to your supervisor, to be honest with your supervisor and ask for help, but also connect with other PhD students or people in your department, because everyone wants you to succeed. Maybe this is not something that we think when we do our PhD because we are too focused on our project, but actually everyone wants us to do well. So connect with others. And also I will say, look after yourself and take regular breaks because that will help you also with your productivity. So and enjoy the process.
Yeah, and that's some wise advice, whether you're in a crisis in a pandemic or not. I think there, Matilda, I think we'll have to get you a job in supporting graduate students somewhere along the line. Trish, I know you got out in Ireland. We say you got out the gap. You got out the gap just in time by the sounds of things.
Yeah.
But you were still impacted a little bit towards the end. But what advice would you give a PhD student who would find themselves in the same situation? And would you have done anything differently towards the end of your PhD if it wasn't for COVID? Or if you were to look back and say, could I have finished that off differently?
Yeah, probably the only thing I'd change on reflection is the kind of group of PhD, other people doing their PhDs at the time. We had, you know, some really good connections pre-COVID and maybe didn't maintain those as well during, you know, people were at different parts and different stages of their PhD. You know, we were also busy doing other things, you know, lockdown at home. So I think probably, you know, just like Matilda and Kira said, keeping those connections with your peers as well, you know, that supportive element. But I think, you know, on reflection, even though I was towards the end, you know, that creativity, seeing those challenges as opportunities to become creative and think, you know, outside the box when you're, you know, faced with whatever it is at whatever stage you're at. So I was at the write-up. So things like, you know, my analysis needing some help with the stats from, you know, a statistician, that I was able to still be able to do that. And even though I wasn't able to meet them face to face, well, inside in SETU, but, you know, getting on the beach, okay, you're a couple of metres apart, this is what I need from you, and, you know, you can go back up to the house, you know, get some stuff done, have some email, communication, and, you know, that worked really well. So I think you just seeing a challenge, and I know it's a bit of a cliche, as an opportunity, and just trying to think your way through those challenges, you know, and taking the time to do that, and using support from supervisors and peers for sure.
Okay, that's really powerful. I just want to conclude my piece here by saying, look, it's quite obvious from listening to you all that you had the flex to be able to and the thinking on the feet and the innovation and the creativity to pivot. And that's quite obvious from everybody who spoke here today. Where did that comes as a healthcare professional as compared to other disciplines, I don't know, but. You know, the challenges that you met, everyone who's been on talking here today has definitely been able to readjust And that's that shows real sign of resilience. And that comes across really, really strongly talking to you all here today. I'm going to hand over to Gordon here, who's just going to wrap up and say just a couple of words to conclude. But I just want to thank everybody who's been on the call and part of the podcast today for sharing, for being so honest and for reflecting back on what was a difficult time for everybody during the pandemic.
Thanks very much, Mark. And I would just like to echo what you've said there. And I think for me, I think not only will your advice be useful for other people doing PhD, but I think researchers more widely about the resilience that you showed and the adaptability that you showed in it. And I think things like Matilda's suggestion about thinking about that very early in the research process and thinking about it when you're filling in your ethics forms or your protocols and so forth, I think it's really, really useful advice. So I'd just like to finish off by just thanking everyone really so much for your contributions today. It's been really, really interesting, and I'm sure that the listeners and viewers will find that as well. So thanks to Mark, and thanks to Trish, Matilda, Kira and Teresa. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of 9 Plus. For more information about this topic, keep an eye out for the upcoming issue of the Journal of Research in Nursing, or check out the SETU or Glasgow Caledonian websites. You can stay up to date with the podcast by following us on Twitter at 9 Plus Podcast. Thanks.